Our topic for this evening is the Frankfurt Friends of Reform and the controversy over Bris. Okay. So, Frankfurt on Main was one of the leading, if not the leading Jewish community in Germany in the 18th and 19th centuries. And its political fate, from a Jewish point of view, well, had its ups and downs. Full emancipation was not achieved until 1864, but there were various stages of emancipation all throughout the early decades of the 19th century. And with the stirrings of emancipation came economic progress and wealth. And what comes along with wealth? The desire for the reformation of religion, typically the case. The first progressive institution, Jewishly speaking, in the city was the Philanthropin School, which was founded in 1804 and provided an education, a secular education, with limited Judaic supplement, to the Jewish underclass. Not for the wealthy, but for the lower classes to educate their children. And in this Philanthropin School, like several other similar type schools in Central Europe, there was the opportunity for devotional exercises. Now, what are devotional exercises?
Prayer.
I wouldn't call it davening. Chapel. Devotional, so it's a chapel service of some kind.
Like the English schools?
Yeah. So, in these services, there will be a modicum of Hebrew prayer, but also German language devotional exercises. The main synagogue of Frankfurt did not move at all in the direction of reform because its rabbis were old line rabbis. In the early 1840s, the time under discussion, the rabbi was Solomon Trier, and he was an old world rabbi, an elderly man, and his two underling assistant rabbis were also of purely Orthodox variety. And so the communal synagogue did not satisfy those with reformist tendencies. But there were plenty of Jews with reformist tendencies because as the children who were educated in the Philanthropin became of age, they wanted religious services that were closer to what they were accustomed to in their educational years. So there is a desire for something, but it isn't happening. And in 1841, there is the establishment of the Society of the Dawn. The Dawn. D-A-W-N. Now, the Dawn, the Shachar, always implies new, better than the darkness of the past. It's an implied or not so implied shtach on the Judaism that was before, that this will be somehow better. This was followed by an op-ed piece that came out in which the members of the society declared that they do not subscribe to Talmudical ceremonialism, which separates Israelites from their fellow citizens. And they had a following gripe. How long will the Talmud devotees confound the pure religion of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Micah with ceremonial religion of the Pharisees? That's tough language. It's basically saying, of the Jewish past, who were the good guys? The prophets, like Micah and Isaiah and the like. And who are the people to be embarrassed by? The Pharisees and their ceremonial religion, the Talmud. So this is anti-rabbinic Judaism in the extreme. Now, a year later, the Society for the Friends of Reform was established in Frankfurt. And this society is going to develop a platform that is the most radical reform platform that will ever exist. It will go well beyond what could be reasonably expected from rabbis with reformist tendencies, and even the reform rabbis, with one exception, will condemn this society as having gone too far. It's interesting who that one rabbi was who didn't condemn them. We'll talk about him soon. But before this society was founded, there was an article that appeared in Abraham Geiger's journal in which an anonymous author complained that the rabbis with progressive tendencies should be more active in separating the undesirable elements of religion from the pure, pristine elements of religion. That we should get rid of those things which whose day has come and gone, and elevate on a pedestal the core, the fundamental principles that should guide the Judaism of the future. But because the rabbis are weak-kneed and are not willing to take any chances, because after all they are communal officials who don't want to alienate certain sectors of the population, they don't take the necessary progressive measures. So it becomes up to us, the non-theologians, the laymen, the non-intellectual, to say what needs to be said and to do what needs to be done. Of course, you could imagine the Reform rabbis, while they might agree in principle with some of the things this society is about to do, are not going to take kindly to being told that you're a bunch of yellow-bellied chickens, you're too afraid, you're a bunch of cowards to do the necessary measures of reform.
When is the first Reform rabbi?
Uh-huh. Well, it's hard to give an exact date, but...
Someone stood up and said, I am now a Reform rabbi.
In the 1830s. Yeah. Okay. So,
we're not talking about somebody who was ordained Reform.
No, we're talking about someone who proclaims himself of the Reform camp. All right. So, this group is a very anti-intellectual group. They don't know much, Judaically. That's not to say that they're secondly ignorant. No, they might be very well educated with university degrees, and very prominent doctors and barristers are involved in this Society for the Friends of Reform. But they don't know Judaism. Plain and simple, they just don't know much. And they develop a platform, which is a complete break from the past. It originally had five planks, two of which would be deleted because they were too controversial. But I'll read you the original, uncensored version, and then I'll tell you what got stricken from the record. Point number one, they consider the Mosaic religion capable of continuous development. Continuous development. What does that mean?
No stagnation by the Orthodox.
So no stagnation by an Orthodox party. And it means an evolution over time. So continuous development says that we don't necessarily have to attack what was in order for tomorrow's religion to look differently. It's not necessarily an assault on what was a generation ago if we do something that has a different flavor. It's just because the times call for this new development. Two, that they do not consider binding the various ritual, dietary, and other laws concerning bodily practices that emanated from the ancient polity. In other words, no, you don't have to keep kosher anymore and put on tefillin and ceremonial mitzvot that made sense in the land of Israel under Jewish sovereignty 23 centuries earlier, don't make sense in 19th century Central Europe and therefore are no longer binding. Yeah.
So there was no concept of chok versus mitzvah.
Absolutely not. Absolutely. Chok is pointless.
Yeah.
Yeah. Point three, they do not consider circumcision binding either as a religious act or a symbol. Of course, that's going to be a very controversial point. Number four, they do not recognize the Talmud as authoritative. And five, they do not expect or long for a Messiah who will lead the Jews back to Palestine. Okay, of the 5 points, two of them were deleted. Which ones do you think were deleted?
Circumcision.
Circumcision and?
Messiah.
No.
Messiah.
No. The ritual laws, the dietary laws one. Now, not because all of a sudden they had a change of heart and wanted to be more frum. No. What they realized was, you can't have a platform that is entirely negative and stresses how you don't want to do X, Y, or Z thing. Because why specify any particular mitzvah if you're throwing out the whole edifice of the halakha and the notion of ceremonial mitzvot? It doesn't pay to alienate more people by identifying a specific mitzvah that you want to get rid of. But, yeah?
You're describing the things that they wanted to change,
yes,
and remove in terms of the practice. What was their anchor point?
Ah, okay, so the critics would say that they had none. They will say that they do have one, and in about a minute we'll address what that might be. Okay, so they hold on to, in the final version of the platform, the notion of continuous development in religion, the idea that the Talmud is not authoritative, and lastly, that there's no return to Palestine. No, no, no. In fact, they never do, because this group dies a not-so-natural death a few years after it starts. They don't have a congregation. All right. About 50 people signed this platform and were members of the Society of the Friends of Reform. That's not a great number, and it extended beyond Frankfurt, so they couldn't get that many signatures. And it was assaulted by all of the rabbis. The rabbis don't like this at all. Why not? Aside from the fact that they were excluded from developing the platform, which is always a personal gripe that you could have. So,
which rabbis are you talking about?
The Orthodox rabbis, of course, are going to oppose it, but even the Reformist rabbis don't like it. Okay, so their power has been usurped to an extent. But more than that, there were those who felt that this is a declaration of unbelief, not a declaration of belief. If it's those who were favorable to it would say it's a declaration of independence for Judaism. Those who were against it would say it's a declaration of independence from Judaism. And you have the same thing in America in 1885 with the Pittsburgh Platform. Okay, so even a fellow like David Einhorn, who would become an extreme radical, said it's a confession of unbelief. Well, those who defended it would make the following point. And Meyer Stern, who was its greatest defender, he had the following point. We are not reformers. We could not and would not be. We are merely reformed. The age, advanced, intelligent, and possibly also progressive rabbinism are the reformers. Meaning, this era of time, this period in Jewish history, that is the engine of reform. We just happen to be the human byproduct. We are reformed, ED at the end, not reformers. We're not doing anything. We just simply exist as Jews who don't practice, don't have the old line beliefs, and we're here to express the reality. We're not here to do anything else. That's what the defenders of the society would say. And you know what? They're being honest in that respect. They're not really doing anything. They're just openly and very honestly and forthrightly declaring what their convictions are, and which are totally at odds with traditional Judaism. As simple as that. Okay.
Why did they call it Judaism?
Okay. So the answer to that is, and it was explained in one of the op-ed pieces in the Zeitung, in the Philipson's German Jewish newspaper, there are two options for a Jew who no longer subscribes to traditional beliefs and doesn't in their personal life do practical mitzvot. One is to remain within the camp of Judaism in a community where there is no reform option and sort of bite their tongue and continue participating in communal life despite this not really expressing their true religious sentiment.
Like Israel today.
To a large extent, yes, yes, I would agree with that. Or to become an adherent of another religion. In other words, to be a Meshumet, to be converted to Christianity.
How about an atheist?
Okay, so that's not an option. Because number one, they're not atheists. They're not atheists. They believe in God. They don't want to have no confession. But moreover, the government doesn't allow that. You have to participate in some creed, in some recognized religious group. In America, we Americans are accustomed to a separation of church and state, where if I want to be a non-confessor, a simple atheist, agnostic, no one can push me around and tell me what to do. But in Central Europe at that time, you had to be a member of a recognized faith. So if you're born a Jew and you have an aversion to apostasy and you have no love for the doctrines of Christianity, that's out. What about Judaism? Well, you don't really like that either, and you don't really practice it in the way that it was traditionally practiced. So what is there available to you? Nothing. So the Society, the Friends of Reform, are saying we're creating the third option for those Jews who fall into this category. Because they don't want to fake it. That's their whole point. They want to have sincerity. They want to close the gap between true personal belief and the practical religion with which they are affiliated.
Did they have anything like a cultural Jew?
Yeah, plenty of cultural Jews exist in every generation. It's just that whereas today you can have you can have that manifest itself in cultural institutions that are not non-denominational, back then you really didn't have that.
So is that mentality what gave the ability of people to convert to Christianity for
for economic purposes or for education.
So if
purposes.
People if people have forsaken Judaism and no longer are repulsed by the thought of submitting to baptism, then they're going to go ahead and do it. Whether it's sincere, most likely it isn't sincere, but plenty of people in the 19th century did just that. Their attachments to Judaism had waned, and their aversion to all Christian symbolism was no longer as entrenched as it might have been in a bygone era. Okay, so those who supported this society claimed that the main pillar of true religion is the spreading of belief in one God and in the progressive arc of human civilization. That the goal is to advance the cause of belief in this God, and the Jews will play a role in doing that. But that there's nothing eternal about ceremonial Judaism. So there are certain things that might be preserved, but a whole lot will not be preserved, and anything is up for a discussion. Anything is up for a discussion. Even things as essential as bris. Okay. Critics of the Reform Society said that their appeal to pure Mosaism, the religion of Moses, is all a bluff. What is Mosaism? What's in the law of Moses? Give me a few things that are in the law of Moses, in the five books of Moses. The priesthood, animal sacrifices, blood vengeance. The Bible is pretty backward, okay?
Slavery.
So how can you claim that you are the vanguard of progressive religion by throwing the Talmud under the bus and elevating the status of the law of Moses? The law of Moses is from 3,300 years ago and reflects it. Okay, so Bruno Bauer, who was an anti-Semite...
You can't understand the Torah without understanding the Talmud.
That's true. There are certain things that are vague and amorphous, and we don't know without some explanation. But there are certain basic things in the Mosaic law that that a 19th century person would find abhorrent. So Bruno Bauer, who was no friend of the Jews, said that Mosaism means sacrifice, priestly class, peculiar property legislation, and that its logical consequences are the Talmud. So anyone who claims otherwise, that the Talmud is not the logical consequence of the Torah, and that the Torah is somehow very enlightened and modern, are simply lying. They're spinning a yarn that this doesn't hold true. Yes. Okay. What about the non-belief in the Messiah and the restoration of Zion? So the critics of the Reform Society say that by advancing this point of view, you, the society, are throwing away a cardinal principle of Judaism that has been around from time immemorial. A basic tenet of Judaism is Shivat Zion, Kibbutz Galuyot, Imot HaMashiach. Put it all together. Some end-of-day scenario whereby the grandeur of the past is restored for our people and for our faith.
But that was not in the Old Testament.
Oh, okay. So the Society for the Friends of Reform would argue that as much as Jews want to believe that, and it has been entrenched in Rabbinic Judaism, it's not in the Torah, it's not in the early books of the Nevi'im, it's barely in the latter books of the Nevi'im, and it's a late accretion to Judaism, that if we were to get rid of it, it wouldn't be the end of the world. What do you think of that? So metaphorically, it's hope, and among the reformers, it will be transformed into a hope for universal human brotherhood and a better future. The idea of the better future is preserved. It's just that it need not take place geographically for our people in the Middle East. It can happen...
It's not parochial. It becomes universal.
Correct. Correct. So that's at that time because our ancestors needed a place to live. But having been exiled and having gone to places of friendly dispersion, like Central Europe, by the standards of the 1840s, there's no need to leave. No need to go back to where we once were.
Did the question come up at that point of dual loyalty?
Not really. The dual loyalty question played a role in the 1819 Hamburg controversy over the prayer book. And the Orthodox said, well, we've been praying for this all this so many years and no one ever accused us of dual loyalty in the medieval times, so why should we worry about it now? And the only ones who really were worried about it were the reformers. So the Jews were their one worst enemy. Yeah.
Two questions. First of all, I think that the impact of colonialism and of the Enlightenment enlightened, you know, European countries having the white man's burden of taking, you know, the aboriginal societies and giving them roads and education. And they don't want to identify with that. They want to go as far away from that as possible. So maybe that was part, you know, of the reason why they wanted to, you know, expunge all of these symbols that would make them particularly oriental.
So that's an important point. Getting rid of symbols that are from a different part of the world is a very important plank in their agenda.
Imperialism, this was the time of, you know, the white man's burden.
You don't want to look like you're from a different continent.
Right. But, on the other hand, the prophetic Judaism that they cherish so much, you look at the different books of Yirmiyahu, Yeshayahu, there's plenty of references to God's vengeance on the people who were made Israel suffer.
Yes, that's true.
They kept that.
Okay, so the notion of God's vengeance against those who made Israel suffer is something that doesn't play an important role in the homiletic literature of the progressive rabbis, because it's an unpleasant thought, and the theory is that we've moved past that era in time and life is better among our friendly non-co-religionists, and so we need not worry about that sort of thing anymore. In some places the Haftorah was put into the vernacular. Okay, so one big criticism of the Society of the Friends of Reform was the idea that you reject revelation. If Mosaism is capable of unending or unceasing development, that means that the laws as they were given are not eternal, are not the full expression of God's will, but rather are just the heritage, the religious heritage of the Jews. So it's a watering down of the concept of divine revelation and maybe rejecting it altogether and replacing divine revelation with the zeitgeist, with the spirit of the time as being the determining factor in what guides our behavior. So the defenders of the society say, well, wait a second. You only have two choices. You can either believe in literal divine revelation on a mountaintop somewhere in the Sinai Desert 3,200 years ago, or you can believe in the zeitgeist. There's really nothing in between. And since you, the progressive rabbis, don't really believe in Exodus chapter 19 and 20, as we read on Shavuos morning, you know, you guys don't really think that actually happened, do you? So, really, you agree with us. You just don't want to say it because you're afraid. Is that a fair assessment of what was going on? So, I'll be charitable, and I'll say for some of the progressive rabbis that was probably true. They didn't believe in Exodus 19:20, the Sinai revelation in its traditional sense. They rejected that, but they were reluctant to say it because it would make them into a heretic and could cost them their job. However, among other Reform rabbis, they really did believe in divine revelation and really did believe in the Mosaic authorship of the Torah. Isaac Meir Wise, the granddaddy of American Reform Judaism, was a very firm believer in Torah L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. But he ate pork. Why? Because we no longer have to keep the ceremonial law since the times have changed, and even though it was a true revelation, the spirit of the times is another true revelation. So the society in 1842, in criticizing the Reform rabbis as being basically hypocrites, they're on target for some of the Reform rabbis, but not all of them. Some Reform rabbis really were true believers in Torah Mishamayim, Torah Moshe Mi-Sinai, but that the spirit of the era has abrogated that revelation.
So it seems to me that the Orthodox are really written off. They're not part of this whole discussion.
No, they're not.
It's an Antonitian.
To a great extent, it is until we get to Bris. Then the Orthodox have what to say. Okay, so. All right.
You say this group is really not an educated group.
No. Jewishly. It didn't know much.
Very intelligent.
We're still dealing with a minority.
Oh, a very, very fringe minority at that. Okay. So the Society of the Friends of Reform, their their claim is that we have no desire to secure for ourselves greater political rights than those that are for, that are coming to the Orthodox Party. There was an accusation that, that said, you guys are throwing out Judaism because you want to be emancipated before everyone else. This isn't a matter of debate over religious belief. It's a farce. It's a bluff. Jews don't have full civic rights. You want them. And you think that by getting rid of Judaism, positive substantive Judaism, you'll get rights before the guys who wear tefillin gets rights. That's a very serious accusation. They denied it. They said, no, this has nothing to do with it. We want all Jews to be emancipated simultaneously. This is only about a matter of belief, where we're projecting our sincere convictions and getting rid of that which we no longer believe in. And what about coercion, religious coercion? So, bris was something that the rabbinic authorities still were able to force on the people. Over the last few weeks, we've explained how the power, the police power of the rabbis was on the decline since the late 1700s. And in some places, they had none at all. They could no longer coerce the private religious observance of halakha by Jews in the community. In a bygone era, they could. How? By what means? Chayrim. What else? Corporal punishment? Financial penalties, excommunication, or to a lesser extent, the withholding of synagogue honors. Okay, so there are a variety of tools in the arsenal of the kehillah and the rabbi as the head of the religious head of the kehillah in the pre-modern era. But as those tools are taken away, and as Jews are no longer really interested in being very observant, what do you have? Public desecration of various aspects of the halakha, the Sabbath, the kashrus, and the like.
What about marriages?
So marriage is a little different because you need
kids.
Because you need to have a clergy person officiate at the marriage and register that marriage.
De jure. Let's say you have an Orthodox girl who wants to marry a son of one of these reformers.
Okay, so we're going to see how the rabbis suggested no intermarriage between the various camps, between the Reform and the Orthodox. That wasn't adhered to by the general public, and there's plenty of cross-pollination, but at least such statements were made. Okay, now, the bris was an exception to this rule. The rabbis could still impose bris on an unwilling layman. Why?
How?
How and why?
The guy wanted to know who the Jews were.
Yes. Basically, yes.
Right.
Okay. So the government authorities have an interest in preserving religion, generally speaking. Lav dafka, any particular mitzvah, any ritual. But religion generally, the state wants to have all people be believers and participants in some recognized cult, some recognized form of religion. Because if you're not, if you're an atheist or an agnostic or a non-confessor, can we trust you? No. There's no such thing as secular morality. You need religion. And if you don't have religion, you're a lying son of a gun, and we can't trust your testimony. Okay, religion is the bulwark against dishonesty and corruption of society. At least that's the way early 19th century Christian state believed. So the Jews, absent becoming Christians, have to remain Jewish. What makes you Jewish?
Christian.
So by birth and registration, and from a technical point of view, but why is that registration going to happen in the case of a male child? Because the kid was given a bris.
It's equivalent to having
a baptism, correct. Bris and baptism become one and the same in the eyes of the state. As they would say in Yiddish, Erez Geyiddisht, he was made Jewish because he got a bris. Now, halachically, it's not really true, but in the eyes of the general public and in the eyes of the state, it was true. Okay, so
when does circumcision become a general medical recommended procedure?
in the 20th century, and it was the greatest victory that the Jews pulled over the WASPs. It's true. The Jewish doctors in the 1920s and 30s somehow convinced the medical field in this country that it was a good idea to circumcise all babies in the hospital, right, which helped sustain bris as a Jewish ritual for another two generations. Whereas today it's not as common, from what I'm told. But now they're fighting over it. But there was Jewish influence with an agenda to make that happen. Okay, so the Arabs play no role. This is European Jewish history. All right. Now, so what happens if a family did not want to circumcise their child in the early period under discussion, the early 1800s? So they didn't have to, but it means they have to baptize the kid. Now, there were many Jews who for themselves were unwilling to take the plunge, to go into the baptismal font. They were born a Jew, they're going to die a Jew. A non-believer, and a not a very loyal Jew, but a Jew nonetheless. But as for their children, in light of the fact that the emancipation has not been completed yet, and in order to succeed in general society, you got to be a goy. So what do? You baptize the child. So Benjamin Disraeli falls into that category, yes.
Baptism is more than just the procedure and the ritual of wedding the baby.
Yeah.
It's also an acceptance of Christ, isn't it?
It's supposed to be, from the Christian theological point of view. But we deal in Lamaisa, in the real world. And in the real world, what do Jews want for their kids? Material success. And how do you get material success? With a little hocus pocus provided by the Gentiles. Sure. They tend to ignore it. At least some of the 13 principles,
even
like the middle ones. Yes, of course.
They ignored him.
Yeah. Okay. So in Germany, including in Frankfurt, you have Jews who are born temporarily Jewish, are baptized by their Jewish but not so religious parents, and so the issue of circumcision is skirted. However, oftentimes, the decision to baptize the child doesn't happen right away. It happens after a few weeks or a few months of pressure by the kihila to circumcise the kid, hesitation by the parents, and the continued pressure to circumcise ends up being the straw that breaks the camel's back and leads in the direction of baptism. So if not for the pressure to circumcise, maybe in some of those cases, the kid would have been sort of neither here nor there. But because the kihila is insistent upon bris milah, that forces those not interested in bris milah to go in the direction of baptism. Okay, so you can't be neither here nor there unless you petition the Jewish authorities to register you as a Jew despite the lack of circumcision. So that's the question. The non-pious, the Freie Yidden, they want that option. The Kehila doesn't want that option to exist as a legal matter. And this is going to be a big fight.
What did the state say?
So the state is going to have to answer this question. And the question comes up in 1843.
Going back, did the Catholic Church use this window of opportunity get conversions?
Sure. I mean, there were outreach efforts by the Protestants, specifically the Lutheran Church, and by the Catholics, all throughout the late 18th and early 19th centuries, to capture the attention of Jews who were on the margins of Judaism, who were looking to get out, maybe for non-theological reasons, but once they're taking the baptism, to be converted, sincerely to the true faith. I mean, you had, of Mendelssohn's kids, you have some who fall into that category. Some became Christians just for social convenience, but others became real believers with the help of some pastor along the way. Okay, so in 1843, you have a directive from the Frankfurt Senate that says that a mohel must be authorized to practice his craft by the medical authorities of the town. You can't just be a mohel with no certification. You have to be a recognized mohel who has some training, and the doctors say you're not going to give the kid herpes or whatever. So why did this directive come out? Because there were some tragic episodes of babies who died. Now, truth of the matter is, there were always babies who died. So why 1843? The answer is that in the year 43, or 1043, infant mortality was through the roof. By 1843, science has progressed enough so that infant mortality is now a really sad thing. Like, you expected this baby to live. This is not Mongolia in the year Gimel. This is Germany, Middle Europe. In 1840s, we have some real science and some real medicine. The kids should live. If the kid dies after a circumcision, it wasn't just because he was going to die. It's because the mohel fouled up and gave the kid some kind of disease or butchered him or did something horrible. So therefore, all right, get the doctors involved. Certify the mohel. But the way that the law was passed, it gave the impression that the father of the baby didn't have to get the kid circumcised. The language was that in the event the parent wants to have the kid circumcised, it can only be done by a mohel authorized by the state. So the ambiguity was, do we still follow the old rules that say if you're a Jew, you have to be circumcised, no doubt about it? Or is it now the discretion of the parent? So because of this ambiguity, the Rabbi Trier of Frankfurt has to petition the government, clarify your position, and specifically uphold the old rules. Make sure this is not a discretionary matter, but that you have to get your kid circumcised. Okay.
Now, did the state clarify it?
So the state clarifies it, much to the chagrin of the Orthodox. They do not uphold the old rules. It ends up becoming a discretionary matter. That's not to say that people were en masse no longer circumcising the kid. It just means that another police power of the rabbis was stripped away. Yeah.
Sons were baptized and the daughters were not.
No, forget baptized now. The daughters were registered as Jews just because there's no initiation rite. The kid is born, you put him on the list. For the boy, the Kehillah would refuse to register the kid as a Jew unless there was a circumcision. So it was there was a gender gap here. The girls had no problem. This is the boys who had the problem. Okay. Now, why is it that on the issue of circumcision in particular, the reformers, the Society of the Friends in Frankfurt, were willing to push the envelope? What was it about Bris in particular that they're looking to push their agenda? So it's two things. One is that this was the last item where the Kehillah still had police power and coercive power, and they want to undermine that. But number two, Bris was already under attack from other quarters as being a barbaric act. And not just that it's a barbaric act, it's not even an indigenously Israelitish act, that we borrowed it from the Egyptians in antiquity. The English deists claimed that circumcision was an Egyptian cultic practice, and that the Jews, or the Israelites, stole it from them or copied them and adopted it for their own, but that it's not really the will of God. It's some pagan rite from Africa. Okay, all right, so that was a known theory being thrown around Central and Western Europe. The other consideration is, you can have circumcision without cutting off the foreskin. And what is that? No. Or la talev, the heart. The circumcision of the heart, the foreskin of the heart, not the foreskin of the male organ. That Christianity represents the Brit Milah, the covenant is you get rid of the interposition between your heart, your seat of emotion, and Jesus or whoever's upstairs. Whereas the Jews insist upon a surgery that butchers the male organ of a baby. Now, with that in mind, so what sounds more palatable? The one that doesn't have the surgery. So since circumcision is under assault by the Christians, by the deists, by general modernity, and it's something that still has police power of the rabbis, that's why the reformers are so interested in undermining it. Okay. Also, at the popular level, Bris was losing its hold on the public. It was even among those Jews not ready for baptism, not ready to be mishumadim, regular Jews, regular good, not so religious Jews, in Germany. They no longer viewed Bris as a great moment in the life of the baby where he enters into the covenant of Abraham, but rather it was a necessary evil that you hope passes without a mishap. So the mother and father are not with smiles and grateful to Hashem, they're cringing in the corner waiting for it to be over. Now, from your experiences in the 21st century America, what happens at a Bris? A lot of people are cringing in the corner, all right? It's true. Okay. All right. Now, what do the rabbis, or Rabbi Trier, what do they do to try to bring back the coercive nature of Bris Milah, and in the absence of the government cooperating and doing the bidding of the Orthodox, what other weapon is there in the arsenal of the Orthodox rabbis of Frankfurt to maintain the importance of Bris Milah in the minds of the public? What else could they do? So what happened in 1819 when the Hamburg reformers made their temple? What did the Hamburg Beis Din do? Remember? They sent out epistles, missives, to who? To all the rabbis, for them to weigh in on what's going on. And if the greats of the game, the great rabbis of Europe, will say that the Hamburg Temple is a place of heresy and idolatry and that you're all going to go to hell if you daven there, then what's going to happen? Maybe people won't daven there. All right, because people listen to the Gedolim, right? Well, it's now 1843. Are people still listening to the Gedolim? Not as much. So, it's interesting that whereas the Ela Divrei HaBris of 1819, letters were sent all over Europe, including to Eastern Europe, to Galicia and to Hungary, and even to Russian Poland, in 1843, letters are sent to the rabbis of Germany, Denmark, France, Italy, Vienna, and Prague, but not to Hungary and Poland. Why? Because there are now two types of Ashkenazic Jews. There are the Ostjuden, who are more from and live in a world apart without secularism, and then there's Central and Western Europe, where the Jews are living in a very secular environment. And the rabbis who live in the Eastern lands, they have nothing that they can say that will speak to the experience of the Western Jews. So the best that the Frankfurt rabbis can hope for is that the rabbis of Central and Western Europe will offer something compelling that will get Jews to hold on to Bris. Now, what type of arguments do rabbis typically muster when they have a treatise? What kind of arguments? Halachic arguments, based upon citations from the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch. But interestingly here, that's not the way they go. They turn to philosophical arguments, historical arguments, ethical arguments, cultural arguments, anything but technical halacha. Why? Because they know that the audience has to buy into it, and the audience isn't buying into technical halachic arguments anymore. So it has to be something other, agadic in nature, historical in nature. So, Rabbi Trier writes the following to his colleagues and wants them to agree with it in their own words. He says the following: circumcision is the sign of the Holy Covenant for us and for our descendants for eternity. The obligation to circumcise falls not only upon the father, but also upon the Jewish court, and each and every person in Israel. The father who persists in his sin, and contemptuously with evil intent and renunciation of the Torah, does not allow his son to be circumcised, is a heretic, has left the Jewish people, and is disqualified from giving testimony or taking an oath. Okay, so this is a very serious statement, because by claiming he can't take an oath, what's the big deal? A guy who's not so frum, doesn't even give his kid a bris, can't take an oath in Beis Din? He's not going to want to turn to Beis Din. Where is he going to the rabbis for adjudication? He's not.
He can't use it in the secular.
Correct. He can't testify in a secular court either because of the Mora Judaico. Jews need to have the Jewish oath in order to be believed in a secular court. It's a holdover from medieval times. But in order to do the Mora Judaico, you need the cooperation of whom?
The
rabbis. And the rabbis won't give it. So therefore, the rabbis have this holdover, the marginal Jew, in that he has a secular, a real-world disadvantage if he doesn't capitulate to the demands of the rabbis on bris. To those who would affect them, I think they did understand it.
The average Jewish guy in business.
Yes, very much understood that. Okay, so
that would have been an incentive for more people to get a baptism.
It would have been incentive either to capitulate and give your kid a bris, or to walk away completely and become a goy. Yes, it leaves no room for the Jew on the edge of Judaism who will not comply with Jewish ritual.
But didn't the Jews in Poland also, in the shadow, were forced by society to adhere to the religion? And in other words,
that's true, yeah.
Once they left the shadow, they threw it off.
Okay, so it happens to be that in the Russian lands in Eastern Europe, if the Kehillah wasn't strong, a Jew outside the big cities could try to function as a neither here nor there, neither a Jew nor a Gentile. If they could get away with it, good. In the cities of Central Europe, that wasn't so simple. The bureaucracy was well developed. Everyone had a certain legal status. There was no trying to sort of hide, and just fall off the face of the earth. You couldn't do that. In Eastern Europe, there were ways, later, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you could be an irreligious Jew, and it didn't matter. But we're still talking about 70, 80 years before that, in Central Europe, where people were not religious, but they had to identify somehow in an official manner. Yeah?
So what we haven't spoken about is that of all these changes, Brisk was the singular one which was an irreversible external mark.
Yes.
You got someone to have a Brisk.
You had him forever.
Level, they were with the program until they died.
Yes.
All of these other philosophical or religious changes, the wind could blow a little bit in a different direction.
Uh-huh.
People could change again.
You're right, which is a reason for the traditionalists to hold on for dear life to this one thing, because they know that if they get you early in life, you are in the camp indefinitely, absent some real desire to become a mishumad. Okay, now.
But it seems that this discussion is no longer focused on the reform.
No, it's not. So we've now moved away from the issue of official reform versus the Orthodox. We're now talking about marginal Jews who are looking to break all the bonds of tradition and how the rabbis are going to deal with it. And the rabbis of all stripes, not just the Orthodox, not just the reform, but both of them and everybody in between. So, let's now see, who did Rabbi Trier turn to in his quest for support, that the authorities should impose bris on the public and that the community should stay strong in the face of those who want to walk away from tradition?
Chassam Sofer.
So Chassam Sofer died in 1839. He's gone. He's geographically too far to the east. So all the big Orthodox rabbis of Germany and Western Europe, but not just the Orthodox rabbis. Because even some of the moderate reformers can be counted upon to support the institution of circumcision. And therefore, fellows like Frankel is one of them who weighed in. But the five in particular that I want to mention are Samuel Hirsch, who was a reform rabbi in Luxembourg, Nathan Marcus Adler, who's basically a modern Orthodox rabbi who ends up becoming the chief rabbi of England, but at that time was still in Germany, Isaac Noah Mannheimer, who's the moderate reformer preacher in Vienna, Salman Yehuda Rappaport Shear, who was the basically conservative rabbi in Prague, and Samuel David Lozado Shadal, who in Padua in Italy was Orthodox but of the critical school, of a modern academic school.
Is he the one who wrote the Silat in Sherman?
No, that's Ramchal. but also Luzzatto. Same last name, but not the same person. Definitely not the same person. Separated by 150 years. Okay. So, some of these rabbis will agree, but not all. They all agree on the need to preserve circumcision. But where they're going to have disagreements is the extent to which the government should be petitioned to use the coercive power of the state, and where, if you can't get that, to what extent should the Jewish community get nasty with the recalcitrant Jew to the level of excommunication, to the level of forbidding synagogue honors, to the level of not registering the child as a Jew. That's the major question. So, let's get to some of the key opinions. Seligman Ber Bamberger, the Würzburger Rav, he believed, petition the government. The Würzburger Rav tried to get the government to coerce circumcision, including by means of physical punishment. In other words, you punish the father with corporal, with whipping, malchus, good old-fashioned malchus, if the father doesn't give in. And why? Because the blessings of the state require, or the future of a blessed state requires that you have religious people. You not have atheists and agnostics. So we can't allow Jews to become non-confessors. We have to make sure that Jews stay within the religion. And the state is also interested in making sure Jews stay within the religion. So have the state bludgeon the guy if he doesn't give his kid a bris.
Could the state enforce a Beis Din to do the circumcision?
The Beis Din is very, very much willing. It's a question of whether or not they were allowed to by the secular law.
Well, could the state step in?
Yes, so that's what some of the rabbis want. Okay, what about Chayrim? So you would think, if the Würzburger Rav is in favor of this state coercion, including physical punishment, then alachas kama v'kama, kal v'chomer, you should allow excommunication. But no, bear in mind that the power of excommunication was stripped away in Prussia and in Bavaria and other German states already a few decades earlier. And it's a big no-no. You're not allowed to excommunicate anyone. So therefore, the language of the rabbi from Frankfurt, his letter, was not that we should expel this person from Judaism, but rather this person has expelled himself from Judaism. It's a nuanced difference. We are not doing the act of expulsion. The man, by virtue of his non-compliance, has taken himself out of Klal Yisrael. You like that? Like, it's like a self-imposed kares. Self-imposed kares. Not from Shemayim, the guy did it to himself. Okay. What should you not do? Well, so some of the rabbis said, if he dies, don't bury him. And if he dies, his relatives shouldn't sit shiva for him. Now, we're talking about the father who won't circumcise the kid. We're not talking about the kid. The kid did nothing wrong. Later, if he grows up and continues to refuse to circumcise himself, we'll have to address that at a later time. But for the moment, the issue was the father who was not doing the right thing. Okay, and it's forbidden to make a compact of friendship. So that's a nice way of getting around the cheirim. What is the cheirim? You can't be friendly with the guy. You can't go within dalad amas, 4 cubits of him, which is like 6-8 feet. So you can't be friendly with the guy, which is a wink-wink, you know, cheirim. And you can't eat or drink in his company. All right, so no fraternizing. What about Nathan Marcus Adler? He says, don't count the guy in a minyan, don't call him up to the Torah, don't do kiddushin for him, and don't let him take an oath on a Torah scroll. All right, certain things we take away from the guy.
He may not care.
He might not care, but if we can't get government coercion, we have to do whatever we can do. And what's left in our bag of tricks? These are things that are left in our bag of tricks. Okay, what about Mannheimer? Now, Mannheimer was not an Orthodox rabbi. Was what we might call a middle-of-the-roader, or moderate reform. And he's in Vienna. He's the preacher of Vienna. He's a very important figure in 19th century Judaism. But he takes a very tough line. He says that we should not turn to the state for enforcement because we have too much self-respect for that. So don't get the government involved. But we will refuse to recognize the Jewishness of the child. And so if the government is willing to recognize a hybrid, a sort of a not Jew and not Goy, that's the government's decision. We're not going to get involved and pressure them with lobbying one way or the other. That's a choice the government makes. But as for us, we will not register the kid without a bris as a Jew. So halachically, the kid really is Jewish. However, we're playing hardball. All right.
But he's not getting the government certificate.
So each jurisdiction will be a little bit different in terms of what they will allow. Okay. What about Luzzatto? So Luzzatto is a very tolerant person. By his very nature, he's not a fundamentalist. He's a believer in the Wissenschaft des Judentum. He's a critical scholar, but he's a traditional believer too. He says that we should not include this person in the minyan. Don't call him up for the Torah. No role in the community. Don't take charity from him. He's on the outs. However, if the person were to come to the synagogue, he should be respected and seated as one respects any non-Jew who comes to the synagogue. In other words, we're not going to make it an ugly personal battle. This person has divorced himself from Judaism, so we're going to take that into consideration. But if they reappear, we're not going to be spitting at them and cursing them. Rather, they'll sit down and they'll be passively involved in the synagogue service. Oh, because they might change their mind. He believes that there's a possibility of teshuvah. And so we're blocking the road to teshuvah if we curse the guy and spit at him. Whereas if we treat him decently, maybe he'll change his way and maybe even give the kid a bris.
Who was the audience of these letters? Was it just the rabbinate or was that sent out to
the These general? Letters were published by the Frankfurt Beis Din in the year 1844.
For general
consumption? For general consumption, yes. Now, the last one is Rappaport in Prague. He says, absolutely no government coercion. Don't get them involved. As a matter of principle, it's a disgrace to Judaism to get the government involved. Okay? The government is involved to the extent that it wants to be involved. But the rabbis who want circumcision to be perpetuated should not lobby the government for any particular legal position. Okay.
Now,
So then the Kehila will have to deal with whatever the government says in the final decision. But the point is, the Kehila is not going to vigorously pursue a government policy. Now, all this is a nice discussion about bris, and bris is an important topic. But it's bigger than just bris. We can learn a very valuable lesson here. Just because you're Orthodox doesn't mean you take the most fundamentalist position on any given issue, especially vis-a-vis government involvement. And just because you're heterodox and even possibly reform doesn't mean you're going to be a softy on any given issue. So let's compare Samson Raphael Hirsch on the one hand and Zachariah Frankel on the other. Who's the firmer one?
Hirsch.
And yet, on the issue of bris and coercion, Frankel said, go to the government, lobby them vigorously, try to coerce circumcision and excommunicate and throw people in jail and do everything under the sun to get the kid a bris. And if the father refuses, it's up to the Beis Din, and the Beis Din will grab the kid and get them all with a knife. Okay? Frankel is a hardline fundamentalist on this. And Hirsch said absolutely no government interference. If the father doesn't want to give the kid a bris, so be it.
That makes sense, because an Orthodox Jew would understand that you're saving them because you want to keep them, and you don't want to get the government involved because they have past experience.
Uh-huh.
But a guy like a reform guy figures, oh, well, we have to be buddy-buddy with the
government. No. That's not an accurate depiction of things. But let me explain to you why Hirsch had his viewpoint. Hirsch, as we'll see in a few weeks when we discuss the neo-Orthodox in Germany, Hirsch believes there are two kinds of Jews. Because that's true, those who are loyal to the Torah, to Torah true Jews, and all the others. Frankel believes there is only one kind of Jew. A Jew. A Jew is a Jew is a Jew. So the old "the Jew is a Jew is a Jew" line is a classic non-Orthodox line. And what does it mean? It means simply that we're going to have one standard for everyone. And that standard, if you're a traditionalist, is going to be a very elevated standard. So for Frankl, who's about as traditional as you can get, you know, south of Orthodoxy, well, he wants every Jew to have every Jewish boy to have a bris, and he'll do whatever he can to make that happen. But an Orthodox fellow like Hirsch will say, I care about my people, the Gesetzestreue Yidden, and as for everyone else, if they want to walk away from tradition, that's their business, and I'm not going to stop them. So from 1851, when he moves to Frankfurt, till his death in 1888, Hirsch is the leader of the IRG, the Israelite Religion's Gesellschaft, which is a breakaway Orthodox synagogue. It's not the communal synagogue. He's not the Rav of Frankfurt. He is just the rabbi of the Orthodox breakaway. He cares about his people, and his people are not neglecting to give their kid a bris. As for the regular Jewish community, we care about them, but we don't care that much to get the government involved. They'll do whatever they're going to do. So that's a counterintuitive distinction between the Hirschians and the guys like Frankl. Okay. Just a few more points. We're going over time. One more point. Yeah.
Would there be a concern amongst the Orthodox that the government may go with us on this decision, but if we get them involved in the future, then they go against us on other decisions?
Yes. So in general, there is an awareness in the rabbinate that involving the government has unintended consequences that could be very, very bad. The only question is whether or not the particular issue under discussion is worth taking that chance. And you could argue that for a minor mitzvah, it's not worth it. But for a significant issue like bris, it is worth it, even with the possible problems down the road. Okay, we're out of time. Next session, we'll continue with the last few top points about bris, including what did the radical reform rabbis, who did not advocate the abolition of bris, say in its favor, and what ended up happening in practice with government decision-making.